insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
This is the main event. 8-8-8-9-1-4-9-1-4-9. Come on, stand up and fight.
Well, I'm a lover, not a fighter.
Ivo, knockout.
Welcome back. 888-914-9149. That number is available to you right now. There are a couple lines open, amazingly. That won't last long. But if you call that number now, I would love to talk to you. Maybe you need a second opinion, or you want some advice, or you've got a situation, or you hate what you heard me say and you want to talk about it. Whatever. I'm here for you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Stacy now in Phoenix. Good morning, Stacy.
Hi, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Hi, so I have a question I've been wondering about. When someone, you know, enters purgatory, it's my understanding that you're going to go through suffering. So Will someone know that they're not in hell, but they're in purgatory?
Yes, and the way they will know is because it says in Hebrews 9:27, it's appointed to a man to die once and then the judgment. So that's your exit interview. When you die, You and I and everybody, you have your exit interview, and that's where you're judged. It's your individual personal judgment from the Lord, and then you will know you're going to go to heaven or hell. And if you go to purgatory on your way to heaven, you're certainly going to know it because you just came from your particular judgment.
Oh.
So You know exactly where you're going. And if you're in purgatory, you know. And there's joy, they say, because these are the souls who are destined for heaven. They know They're going to heaven. But the suffering is especially, they're so anxious to get to heaven. They so want to see God and be with all of the saints and angels. But they're not ready yet. So that's where a lot of the suffering comes in. And then once they're free from the purification, then they go straight to heaven. But yeah, they certainly know that they're destined for heaven.
Okay. Thank you. I just been wondering about that. I just wanted to thank you for taking my call and let you know that I do pray for you every night. And I just have a quick favor, if I can ask you really quick.
If I can do it, sure.
My dad, unfortunately, was recently diagnosed with cancer, so just want to ask for your prayers, please.
Oh, I certainly will. What is his name that we can pray for him by name?
His name is PJ.
PJ. All right. Patrick Joseph, if I had to guess.
His real name actually doesn't even start with the P. It's kind of like a nickname growing up, but his real name is Aurelio.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Aurelio. Well, we will pray for him by name and ask God strengthen him and comfort him, and if it's his will, to heal him from this.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And I really appreciate the fact that you pray for us every day. That means an awful lot. Thank you. 888-914-9149. David in Miami, good morning and welcome, sir.
Hello, Patrick?
Yes. Hi.
Yeah. Oh, hi. Last week or a couple of weeks ago, I'm not sure, I heard, I think it was you talking about Jesus Christ saying that, but I say to you, you had heard it said that if a man sleeps with a woman, but I say to you, if he looks upon a woman in his heart, he commits adultery.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been told or something that was actually Jesus Christ coming back to remind them that coveting is part of the law also. So I think God should covet your neighbor's wife. So it was like he was reminding them about it's not just, you know, the act, but it's also the thought that was part of the law. That's what I was thinking. So I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Yes. Let me make sure I'm tracking with what you're saying. Are you drawing attention to the fact that the 9th and 10th commandments are different and yet they're similar? So in the 9th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife or husband for that matter. And in the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. And in the 9th commandment, even though the wife of the other man or the husband of the other woman is not a piece of property, not chattel, not like a lawnmower or an automobile or something like that, even so, there is a there is a similarity with the 10th commandment because of the dimension of coveting in addition to lusting after or engaging in sexual activity with. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly. But also find a little detail that I don't look at it as a different commandment. I look at it as the same commandment because I think, I come from a group of congregation that believes that it's not divided like that. It's together.
Yeah, I could explain that too. I know what you mean. Yeah. So in the Protestant world, it's typically done this way. The first commandment, which is thou shalt not have any strange gods before me, is divided into two commandments. The first part being thou shalt not worship any strange gods before me. The second commandment, in this way of numbering it, is thou shalt not have any graven images of anything in the sky above or the earth beneath or the waters beneath the earth. You shall not bow down before them and worship them. At the end of the Ten Commandments, because the first commandment has now been broken into two, you would wind up with 11 commandments if it weren't for the fact that the ninth and the 10th commandment are combined into one. So that's just coveting your neighbor's, you fill in the blank, his wife, his lawnmower, his car, whatever. But the Catholic Church doesn't number it that way for this reason, that in the first commandment, and you can read about this in Exodus chapter 20, beginning in verse 1, you see that when God gives the commandment to not have any strange gods or worship any strange gods, he then gives an example of that sin. He gives an example of violating that sin, which is to have a graven image. In other words, if you bow down before that graven image and worship it, what have you done? You have worshiped a false god. That's the commandment. So the commandment, in this case, includes an example of how you can break the commandment. But it's not a second commandment. So to have a graven image is not the commandment. You can have graven images. In fact, the Lord, he commands Moses in Exodus chapter, you can begin reading just five chapters later in Exodus 25, where God says to Moses, all right, now I want you to carve graven images. And they are the images of the cherubim, the angels, made of pure gold, by the way. And they sat on top, or they were placed on top of the mercy seat, on top of the Ark of the Covenant. So that's just one of many examples in the Old Testament where God either commanded the carving of graven images, or he certainly permitted it and even blessed it. For example, in Numbers, where the temple that Solomon built, and when it was finally completed and fully furnished, it was filled with graven images, the graven images of oxen holding the brazen sea, the graven images of birds and flowers and lions and an angel. So, for example, in the Holy of Holies, there were 15-foot-tall graven images of angels in the Holy of Holies. And God not only approves of the construction of the temple by Solomon, but he blesses it and everything in it, including graven images. So the sin is to worship a false god, and a graven image that you would worship is an example of that sin. But Exodus chapters 1 through 5 are talking about one sin, not two, because it's not a sin to have a graven image. It is a sin to worship the graven image, but that's getting you right back to the starting point, which is the worship of a false god. Now, when you go further and you look at the coveting part, you see that coveting, the way it's described in verse 17, you shalt not covet your neighbor's house, you shalt not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or his maidservant or his ox or his ass or anything that is your neighbor's. And the church rightfully sees that even though this is said in one sentence, there are two different kinds of coveting that involve two different things. And so given the fact that the wife is not a piece of property, as I said, or she is not chattel like a donkey or an automobile or something like that, the church rightfully expresses this phrase in verse 17 as two distinct commandments, because they are two distinct commandments. So in the Protestant world, you see it the way I talked about earlier. In the Catholic world, you see it the way I just described, and that's the reason why. So I Where is David? Did we lose David? Okay, there's David. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry. I lost track of where you were. But I don't want to over-explain it to you, but do you see the distinction and do you see why the Catholic Church numbers it that way?
Yeah, I could understand that. I can see, yeah. I see.
Okay.
I see the reason.
Now, here's another interesting thing. By chance, does the church that you're referring to, that Protestant group, do they have like a monument of the Ten Commandments out in front of the church, by chance?
I'm not really Protestant, but they do have images, you know, in different areas, you know, different things. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, here's what I'm driving at. And if they don't have it at that Protestant church, so be it. But if you look around, you'll see, and I think it's a beautiful thing when churches, Catholic and Protestant, have out in front. Typically, it would be this big monument, this big stone carved image of the Ten Commandments. I'm sure you've seen those somewhere, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Big and beautiful, and I think it's great. Well, the ironic thing about that, David, especially in the case of a Protestant church, if you look at the tablets on this monument, they have it as thou shalt not worship any strange gods, commandment one. Number two, thou shalt not have any graven images. And then it goes on from there. But the monument itself is a graven image. It's literally a graven image because it's an image of the tablets of the Ten Commandments that have been literally engraved. And I've wondered for a long time now, does the Baptist minister ever stop and think about the fact that he's got the Ten Commandments saying, don't have any graven images, and it's on a graven image, if that makes sense. It's an irony, if you ask me.
Yeah, you're right.
All right. Well, I'm glad I could help, David, and I appreciate your call. Thank you. How about Mike now in New Berlin, Wisconsin? Good morning, Mike.
Yes, good morning. This is my question. I know in the Lutheran faith, they recite the Apostles' Creed and they leave out the word Catholic. And then in the Catholic faith, we recite the Apostles' Creed and we recite the word Catholic, but the word Catholic is not capitalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering about that.
Okay. Well,
and I know it means universal.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So this is it's a function of orthography, and it's the way the word is presented in the text that doesn't require capitalization. Now, if you want to be, I would say, follow the rules of the way English is capitalized, punctuated, etc. To capitalize it would be more consistent with the rules of English. And in some other languages, like the word church, for example, would be lowercase because that's the custom in Spanish, for example. The Catholic Church, the word iglesia, typically is not capitalized. So that's part of what's going on here. It's not in the Catholic Church any kind of concession or admission or suggestion that the church we're speaking of here isn't the Catholic Church with a capital C. But the custom throughout history has been to not capitalize. In fact, if you go back to, let's say, the biblical Greek text, nothing is capitalized. And there are no capitalizations for Jesus or God or church or anything like that because the custom in that language was not to capitalize it. So although there are ideological reasons, such as the one you mentioned where they omit the word Catholic, which is deeply unfortunate because they're missing the point of the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed, which also contains this phrase. It's not the end of the world, and the fact that it's not capitalized in the missalette, in the pew, in the Catholic Church, it's not suggesting that, well, this is not really referring to the Catholic Church because it is, but it's the custom. And I suppose in a way, it also maybe underscores the universality aspect of the church.
Okay.
All right. Are we good?
Explained it. Yes. Very good. Thank you very much,
okay.
Patrick.
You're welcome. Thank you. How about, Norm in Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question on the parable of the talents.
Yeah.
I was wondering your take on it. And you know?
Well, any particular aspect of it, or you want a quick overview?
Well, I heard a sermon on it, and it basically summarized about money. And when I closed my Bible that day, I'm saying, this is not what this is all about. My take is, because we look at the other ones about the 10 virgins in the kingdom of God, and I looked at it as they're not prepared for the kingdom of God. That's what they were thrown in with weeping and gnashing of teeth. And even with the 10 virgins, he didn't even know them, he said. And, and the other one about the slave, he basically, you know, got rid of him too. And it's just like, I look at it as believing and non-believing, because Jesus doesn't need our money. He needs our heart.
Right.
So am I wrong by seeing it this way, or is it, am I looking at this interpretation?
I do think that's a valid interpretation. The talents, as you probably know, because I know you have a strong biblical background, Norm, the talents is, it can be confusing to American English speaking people, because we think of it like a talent for playing the piano or a talent for public speaking. It's actually a unit of measurement, and it can measure wheat or gold or whatever. And so the, I think the thrust of this parable is that the Lord entrusts these servants with certain amounts of goods, and he expects them to steward them and to multiply them. And for me, the guy who is punished is not punished because he didn't, you know, at least preserve it. The fact is, he was given this talent and he did nothing with it. And so, as you know, it's taken and given to the other ones. So I think the thrust of this parable is that the Lord blesses you and he gives you the things necessary to be a good follower of Jesus. I'm sure we would agree on that. Mm-hmm. And you can either sit on that and do nothing with it, in which case you're not a very good follower, or you can say, Lord, with your grace, I'm going to maximize these gifts you've given me for your glory and to be faithful to you. I suppose there are many different elements or layers of meaning that we could deduce from these scripture passages, but for me, that's always been a big one. What do you think?
Well, what scares me the most when he says, verse 30, throw that worthless slave into the outer darkness and the place where they'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And, and then he goes on, talking about the Lord, that I knew you're a hard man, reaping where you did not sow. Basically, he's calling Christ a stealer, a crook, gathering but where you did not scatter no seed.
Yeah, this I understand what you're driving at here. This is actually what's known as an a priori or a fortiori argument. So in that parable, when he, so we're talking here about the dishonest steward, and he says, I know you're a hard man. So he's actually insulting his boss. He's insulting him. He's not really insulting Jesus, because there is a connection here, but let's look at it for a minute. When he, the dishonest steward parable, when he goes back to the people that owe the master money and he tells them to rewrite their invoices so that they will show that they owe less than what they really do owe, you notice that in that parable, the master praises him. And then Jesus says, you see how the children of darkness handle things like that, but you're the children of light. So this is why you have to make friends with dishonest mammon, so that you will be welcomed into the eternal abodes. It's always been a very difficult way to understand it, but the meaning of that parallel is that dishonest mammon is giving alms. And so the unrighteous mammon is earthly goods, wealth, money, stocks, whatever. And if you make use of the unrighteous mammon by giving it to the poor and other forms of of almsgiving, then in essence you're laying up treasure in heaven. And so he's not praising the dishonesty, but he's using it as an a fortiori argument. If even a wicked servant who disrespects his master and tricks his master into giving a lower amount by forging these documents, if even he can be praised for being resourceful, how much more so should you, the children of the light, Jesus says, be that way? And the example in that other parable that he gives is that you be liberal in giving alms. taking this unrighteous mammon and putting it to that kind of good use in that regard. So it is enigmatic, I grant you that. But when you look at it more deeply, you see that Jesus isn't saying, you know, that you are wicked and slothful because you tried to preserve what was there, but because you, the, you know, the third servant, because you didn't do anything with it. And I'll offer you a parallel. I do have to take a break, Norm, but here's a parallel. Remember in those passages where Jesus gives the parable of the fig tree, and he says, cut this tree down because it hasn't borne any fruit. And the servant says, well, could we just let it grow for another year and I'll till it and I'll water it and I'll prune it. And if it still doesn't give any fruit after a year's time, then let's cut it down. Is that okay? And that's the same kind of thing where if the tree doesn't bear fruit, it gets cut down. It goes into the fire. So I see that as a parallel, Norm. I'm glad you called. I sure wish we had more time, but I got to take a break. So thank you. I'll be right back. This hour is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. Join the nation's largest Catholic-oriented credit union and receive $200 when you add a direct deposit. Learn more at NotreDameFCU.com/join. That's NotreDameFCU.com/join.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
We're back, as you can probably tell. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Pat over in Dallas. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, thank
you. I'm calling to thank you very much for speaking your mind, and I agree with you. You don't have to vote for somebody that you don't want to and you don't believe in. But I want to make a point and ask a question to you.
Sure.
Have you considered mixing a little bit of reason with your faith? This is not meant to be rude, but considering the two people we have as alternatives in the presidential election, one candidate has proven himself to be completely unable to be moved by the church, by our prayers, by petitions, by whatever.
And he's and he actually doubles down any chance he gets.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I know. That's my point. Anyway, and the other candidate who has slipped, you're right, seems to be much more likely to support states' rights. Let's say I'm from Texas and we don't want abortion. He's going to support states' rights. He's going to help us out. Or at least he's going to not give us all the grief that we get from elsewhere. And he's much more likely to be moved, I think, by public opinion and by people who are sincere in their pleas. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, it's a reasoned, cogent way of looking at it, Pat. And I don't take any offense at all. I'd like to think that I do mix reason with my faith. I mean, I make every effort to do that. Yeah,
of course you do.
So I won't. I will not disagree with your thought on this issue that it is not unreasonable if those are the parameters. One candidate who is just has this magical knack for always being wrong and reveling in being wrong versus a candidate who may be wrong on some things and right on others, but he's sort of is like a shifting, his views are shifting one way or the other. If that's all we were talking about, and we're just looking at it in that sense, I would say your point is a very good one. And one could, you know, easily say, well, in this case, based on the odds of things getting better, I'll go with that candidate. I would only say that if only it were that simple, if only it weren't so complicated with other issues and things, which adds to the problem. But that scenario you just described, I think, is definitely cogent.
Thank you. I appreciate your show very much. Thank you for your help.
Thank you, Pat. Yeah, you're very nice to call in, and I appreciate you giving me a chance to discuss that with you. 888-914-9149. Did I mention that that number is sponsored by Catholic Order of Foresters? It is. CatholicOrderOfForesters.com. Check them out there. And thank you guys for sponsoring the phone line for this and our other programs. Let's go to Christine now in Detroit. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Okay, so my question is, as a Catholic, is it wrong to feel sympathy and kind of anger at what's going on in Palestine, particularly with like all the children that are being killed? I just see that there's a lot going on in the world right now. And to be fair, I am Middle Eastern. So I have probably a different look on things, being that my history might not necessarily be your history. We know that there's been a longstanding issue in that land. And it seems that, I'm not anti-Semitic by any sense of the word, but it just seems like if you try to say, I'm feeling anger about what's going on, or I'm feeling sympathy. I mean, even these student protesters, while I want them to definitely remain peaceful, I can't say that I would for sure be upset if my children were old enough to be in solidarity with them, saying that, hey, this needs to stop. But I don't know if I'm in the wrong in saying that, or in not having this commitment to Israel and saying, like, no, I support everything they're doing 100%, even just from like a Christian perspective, because it seems like there are Christians, not Catholics, but Christians, that seem to have this unwavering support for Israel, and they use biblical text. And I've talked to priests about this, and I would just really love to hear what you have to say about this.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to discuss it. So I'll offer you a series of different thoughts on this issue, and then I'd like to know what you think about my thoughts on this issue. Okay. So to get to your first question, is it wrong to feel sympathy? No, not at all. I share your sympathy and empathy for the people, the innocent people who are being harmed by the bombings and the missiles and the bullets and the tanks and all that kind of thing. I don't think sympathy is a strong enough word for how you and I feel about this, and you even more so perhaps, just because these members are family. If you're an Arab, and if your family is from this area, all the more reason why you should feel that kind of sympathy. And I feel it too, because these are innocent human beings who are being harmed and killed in large numbers by this terrible situation. So if that was your leading question, no, I don't in any way think that you are wrong to feel that way. In fact, I'd say there'd be something wrong with you if you didn't feel that way, something distinctly non-Christian if you were not to feel that kind of solidarity for them. In my own experience, and like you said, your experience is not my experience, but I'll just share with you a little bit of my own experience, having been to the Holy Land several times. The odd thing about it is I was trying to think about this the other day, Christine. Did I ever get welcomed into a Jewish home by an Israeli Jew, and or get to know any Israeli Jews or have meals with them? And the answer is no, I never have. But in my visits to the Holy Land, countless times, meals with Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Christians, getting to know them, receiving hospitality from them, invitations to their home. Those weren't always possible to do, but longstanding friendships with Palestinians. So I've thought about that, how in terms of personal interaction, many times over, it's all been Palestinian, and it's zero Jewish Israelis. I don't know what that means one way or the other, but that's part of the context for me. So I have a kind of built-in appreciation. That's not really the right word. I have a built-in affinity. That might be a better word. I'm simpatico with the Palestinian people. No, I'm not simpatico with Hamas. I'm not simpatico with the Muslims who rejoiced and who were celebrating on October the 7th as the Israeli hostages were bloodied and in some cases even dead, I suppose, and being brought into Gaza. I have no sympathy for people who do have sympathy for those atrocities. But you're talking about innocent people who are being killed in the crossfire. So I'm immensely concerned for them. and I deplore and am and adamantly against, as I'm sure you are, anything that's being done by the Israelis, by the IDF, that is in any way intentionally targeting these people, harming them, killing them. I'm absolutely against that. And yet, I recognize that Israel has the right to live, to survive. And the strange thing about all of it, Christine, I'll sort of leave it at this point because I'd like to know what you think about my thoughts here, is that the demonstrators that you're referring to on the campus of Columbia and the other schools is sort of spreading around the country. I have zero sympathy for them because, number one, most of them don't even know what the issues really are. Many of these young people are empty-headed, easily led, easily influenced, and they don't really know other than the slogans that they're hearing from the pro, and let's face it, a great deal of this is pro-Hamas, not pro-innocent women and children. That's one of the things that they talk about, but this is really sort of orchestrated by the people who want Hamas to win, and I don't. I want them to lose. I want them to go away, just like ISIS and Al-Qaeda and all the other groups like that. I want them defeated and eliminated. I don't think that the college students who are, and others, they're not all students, by the way, I think many of them have been infected by a terrible disease of the mind, and this is seen by their continuous chanting and calling for genocide against the Jews, which I find reprehensible. I will be just as staunchly outspoken in defense of Jews as I will be of the innocent Palestinian people who are being killed, because it's wrong in either direction. And I can't take a stand against one group or another if I'm going to be consistent as a believer in Jesus, as a follower of Jesus. I have to be consistent. And the consistency is to publicly stand up for the people who are being harmed. And in this case, the genesis, at least the immediate or recent genesis of this, were the October 7th attacks and the terrible things that I know that you know were being done to the innocent people who were attacked on that day. So that's the approach that I take. I am absolutely by no means somebody who says whatever Israel does is fine. I don't hold that view, never have held that view. I absolutely have, at least from my own, you know, somewhat limited personal interactions with the Palestinian people, both Christians and Muslims, primarily Christians, but also some Muslims as well. I have a great affinity for them and a love for them and a desire to see them happy and peaceful. But doggone it, these terrible, diabolical groups like Hamas, they won't allow them to have peace. And they hide their weapons depots and their terrorist strongholds and their rocket launchers and all those things. They intentionally hide them in schools and hospitals and under homes and things like that. And they do it on purpose because those people, Hamas and others, all they care about is let's kill all the Jews we can. Let's overthrow Israel. Let's get rid of Israel. Death to Jews, all that kind of thing. I am absolutely, utterly opposed to that. And the terrible dilemma is that you've got the innocent Palestinian people who are now caught between two warring groups, and Hamas uses them as cannon fodder. I'll leave it at that. There's so much more that one could say, but those are my thoughts off the cuff, Christine. I'd like to know your critique or your thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, I'm not in the least surprised that those people treated you with hospitality. My culture is all about that. You would probably be treated like that in any Middle Eastern country you went to.
I believe it.
I feel like you are in a different boat than I am because, see, I'm an American citizen, but being that I am Arab, I would never even feel safe to go to Israel. I've heard stories of what they do at checkpoints to Arabs and things like that from just personal people that I know. So I would just be too scared. So unfortunately, I don't know if I'll ever have the chance to see the Holy Land. You know, but I guess all I can say is I agree with you about the Hamas. Obviously, I'm not pro Hamas at all. It sucks that they did what they did. I do believe it goes further than October 7th. So I do believe that a lot of the protesters you're right. They probably don't know about that. It'd be different if there was, some people didn't even know about this until October 7th.
Right.
So it would be different if these people have been following this for the last 75 years and what's been going on. I think for me, I just wish the reporting was done on both sides. So like Hamas did awful things and the IDF is doing awful things. Hamas, you know, did something that was a crime and the IDF has done something that's a crime. And I wish that the reporting on those things was more equal. Like, for example, one of the Instagram journalists that I follow, they're saying that they are finding mass graves in Palestine, people with their hands tied behind their back, women, children, executed. Now, I didn't see that in the Western news. So if those things are happening, certainly right to defend yourself to an extent, but there are like war crimes that are involved. So I think it gets murky.
And I totally agree. And by the way, I'm not here to apologize for the whatever faults may be present in the way things are reported.
And I do know that the U.S. and Israel, I mean, for lack of a better word, they're best friends. So I don't know what they would be willing to report and not willing to report. And that's sort of why I said that we have different history, because I've had access to international news, you know, whereas a lot of people from here, they just have access to this news, you know, not like necessarily a Middle Eastern broadcaster speaking in Arabic, telling you what's going on. I'm not here to debate anything. I'm just telling you my feelings.
No, I appreciate it. And I think that you and I are more or less on the same page, if not entirely, of course. Here, maybe you can help me with something, because I puzzled over this and sure. I'd be curious to know, because you come from that ethnicity. I have difficulty understanding, and I'm not aiming this at you, don't misunderstand me, but there are 10, 20, 30, 40, 100 times more innocent Muslim men, women, and children being killed right next door in Syria by bullets and bombs. There are mass graves, people being tortured, and I don't hear any outcry at all among the Muslim community. Now, I realize that you're not Muslim, you're a Catholic, I understand that, but let's just say the Arab community, zero comment about that. There's no outrage, there are no protests, there's nothing being said about the genocide that's being perpetrated against innocent men, women, and children, Muslims, just a few miles away. I don't understand that. And for me, part of what I see is this constant, and I'm, again, not saying this about you, but looking, for example, at the protesters on the college campuses, there's this outraged hostility against Israel. I can't help but think, is it because they're Jewish and they hate the Jews and let's kill the Jews and genocide to the Jews? None of those things I attribute to you, Christine. But they're saying those things. And so all of this outrage to me, when I see it from those people, it seems fake, because it seems that it's like they're becoming tools of Hamas. They're becoming tools of political/terrorist movements that can whip people into a frenzy because the Jews are doing this, whereas zero is being said at all. And if I'm missing something, please tell me where I'll find it. But where's the outrage and the protests for the hundreds of thousands now? We're getting probably close to a million Muslim Arabs who are killed in Syria, not to mention elsewhere around the world. And nobody says a thing about that. That's a puzzle to me. What do you think?
You're right. People probably don't even know what's going on in Sudan or the Congo or any of those things. I do know that there are people like me, like who are genuinely like affected by what's going on, you know, who have the good intentions. They're not just, random college people that you have a clue. There are people that are like educated and are upset about this. And those people, those very same people actually speak out on all those issues. So like, this is the personal people in my life that I know address and speak out on all those issues.
If only they had platforms, because you don't hear zero about that.
I mean, right.
Christine, if I may offer my thought here, that's why I have a hard time taking these college campus protesters seriously. I don't take them seriously because they're either, what they're really doing, it seems to me, is expressing their hatred of Jews, or they're just so utterly ignorant that they really would have their time better spent reading books and learning about things before they go out and demonstrate about things they really don't know anything about. And I don't know which it is, probably one for some.
Truthfully, I haven't gone to a campus to see what's going on. The latest that I saw that upset me was that on the other side, they were in UCLA, they were attacking the Palestinian protest, the pro-Palestine protesters. Mm-hmm. I mean, attacking them. The police are under investigation because it lasted for 2 hours without anybody showing up. So then part of me, on the same front where you say you think people are hating the Jews, I'm like, are people hating the Arabs? Because why is nobody helping them when they're being attacked?
So yeah, I know what you mean. And by the way, this is not an excuse. Please understand where I'm coming from. But we have to reckon with the fact that the United States of America on September the 11th was attacked by Muslim Arabs. And that left a deep scar. And it injured the psyche of Americans, some more than others. That's, like it or not, part of the mindset. And, you know, the one terrorist attack after another, and all of the ones that I'm referring to here being perpetrated by jihadists, Muslim jihadists. So there is a kind of built-in wariness on the part of many Americans because of how these things have unfolded. But I'm really overdue for a break, Christine. If only you and I had three hours to talk about this issue, I would welcome that.
No, you're fine. And I really appreciate just your kindness. Thank you.
You're welcome. Not only my thanks to you, but please pass on my kind regards to your family and let them know that I, like you, deplore the terrible loss of life and the innocent people in Gaza and elsewhere. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. I hope you'll join me this June for sponsor Christendom College's Summer Consortium. I'll serve as MC for the weekend, celebrating the legacy of St. John Paul II. Register at jp2weekend.com. That's jp2weekend.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
Got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I heard my name called. Let's see. Let's go to Michelle in Illinois. Good morning, Michelle. Hi.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about why you don't hear as much about the Muslim-on-Muslim killing in the other countries.
Okay.
And I believe that's because there's nothing we can do about that. But we are kind of complicit because we, with Israel, because we fund them. And I think that's why.
Okay. That's a valid point, and I don't disagree with you, Michelle. But just to clarify, my point on that earlier was not like, what does the average American think? I'm talking about why among Muslims, why among Arabs, is there no outcry? In other words,
know why the Arabs don't.
Well, that's my point. Yeah. So I think most Americans are probably way behind the curve when it comes to knowing, and I don't claim to be an expert by any means, but I feel like I know more about these issues than maybe a lot of other people in this country do. But I'm not even talking about them. I'm just saying, where is the outcry? From the Muslim world about all those innocent Muslim men, women, and children being killed in Syria and elsewhere. My earlier caller mentioned, you know, the depredations going on in Africa and elsewhere. I mean, we're talking like millions of people who are being slaughtered by Muslims, and there's no outcry in the rest of the world by that. So I grant your point about the United States and being close partners with Israel, but that wasn't really the focus of my question. Does that make sense?
Oh, I see. Yeah, that makes sense. But maybe they have an outcry about this because they know that Americans do help Israel.
I think if you want to know the honest truth, Michelle, it's hatred of Jews. I think that's the fundamental reason that's driving this, is they hate Jews. And the reason I think that's a valid point is because they call so often, so consistently, they call for genocide against the Jews everywhere. We're not talking about the Jews who live in Israel alone. They want to kill Jews everywhere in the world. And that is something we all have to stand up against. It's shameful to me. No, I'm not talking about you, but it's shameful to me. And I don't even know how to express how outrageous it makes me feel, or how outraged, that there are Catholics who go along with that hatred of Jews.
Why would Catholics go along with that?
I know, exactly. Why would they? It's contrary to the gospel. But it doesn't take much to bring the Jew hatred to the surface in many cases. And personally, it seems to me, and I draw this conclusion, Michelle, because what is the distinction? What's the difference between what's going on in Gaza and what's going on in Syria, just miles apart, and huge numbers of innocent men, women, and children, Muslim, Arabs, being killed in Syria? And by comparison, I mean, it's an unacceptable amount, 30,000 or whatever the total number of that is. It's still unacceptable and reprehensible, but it's far smaller, the number of innocent men, women, and children who are being slaughtered in Gaza. Everybody's freaking out about that, and okay, rightfully so. Nobody's freaking out about the vast numbers more being killed in Syria. And the only distinction between the two that I can see is that it's Jews doing it in Gaza, and it's Muslims doing it in Syria. Therefore, nobody says a peep about what's happening in Syria. I don't see any other difference between the two, other than one group is Jewish.
I do think there is anti-Semitism, that's for sure. But the Muslims are Semites too, aren't they?
The Muslims are what?
They're also Semites, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They are. I think in the public, or not the public, in the colloquial sense of the word anti-Semitism has come to, the connotation is now anti-Jewish. But ethnically speaking, sure, the Arabs are Semites. But I don't think people, when they talk about anti-Semitism, that they mean the Muslims or that they mean the Arabs per se. Anyway, thank you, Michelle. Thanks for letting me talk a little bit more about that. And we'll go to Annie now in Los Angeles. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Patrick. Bottom line here is I'm hoping that you could help me with my feelings of guilt and sadness over the potential loss of heaven for myself and for my children, for myself. It's for having lived, in a moral life. And now my two adult children live homosexual lifestyles. And I'm stuck with this sadness and fear and don't know how to navigate them.
I can understand. So let's pause on that for a moment. Let's talk about you for a moment, okay? We'll put the issue of the kids off to the side for a minute, okay?
Okay.
Okay. So you, Annie, are like St. Mary Magdalene. St. Mary Magdalene lived a very immoral life. We're told that seven demons were cast out of her. So if any woman could be saved and loved and healed from a deeply immoral lifestyle, it was St. Mary Magdalene. And who was there at the foot of the cross as Jesus was dying? His mother, St. John, Mary, the wife of Cleophas, and St. Mary Magdalene. So she became a hero of virtue and fidelity to Jesus. And even though she had a very wicked past, her sins were not more powerful than God's grace, nor are yours. So perhaps if you ask St. Mary Magdalene to pray for you, to intercede for you, and you can read her story, of course, in the Gospels, and put yourself in her situation and say, Lord, you healed her and you forgave her and you restored her and you loved her and I know that you can do all those things for me. So your eternal salvation is not in jeopardy at all, Annie. To the extent that you're sorry for your sins, you make a good confession, and maybe you've already done these things, but I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yes, I have been in confession, and that's another issue I have. I think how I don't believe I deliberately ever left, you know, any sins out. Mm-hmm. However, sometimes I think that wasn't a good confession. That wasn't thorough. Yeah. That wasn't, you know.
You get those thoughts afterward, like, you know, did I get everything out there? Do me a favor. I have to go, and I have no choice mm-hmm. in the matter because the show is just about over.
Okay.
Would you be able to call me tomorrow? Where we can talk about it at greater length?
I will try to do that.
Okay. I hope you will, Annie. I really would like to talk to you more about this, and I do have some additional thoughts that I think can help you. So if you're able, please call me tomorrow. Let them know we talked today, and we'll bump you to the top of the list. And until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me.